The Israeli forces once again stormed Al-Nasser Hospital in southern Gaza as the regime's unrelenting airstrikes claimed more civilian lives throughout the besieged territory. An Israeli airstrike targeted a car in the occupied West Bank city of Jenin, killing two Palestinians. And people in New York hold yet another rally against the U.S. government's support for Israel's genocide in Gaza. Israel has struck several residential buildings in central Gaza, killing at least 40 people and injuring over 100 others. The city of Deir al-Balah and the town of Zawiya were the latest targets hit by the regime's air strikes, which also hit the southern city of Rafah, where some 1.4 million Palestinians have sought shelter. Gaza's health ministry says Israeli troops once again stormed Al-Nasser Medical Complex in the southern city of Khan Yunis after a brief withdrawal. They've surrounded the facility now, preventing the entry or exit of medical staff and civilians. Meanwhile, the World Health Organization says it's managed to evacuate 51 patients from the hospital, but 140 others are still stranded there.
WHO so far conducted three high-risk missions into Nasser Hospital and managed to evacuate 51 patients to the hospitals in the south, but we still have around 140 patients remaining in the hospital. Those figures unfortunately change on every hour basis because of the hostilities. Some patients leave themselves. A lot of patients remain in the hospital, but some patients also unfortunately succumb to the wounds that because they went to the hospital.
Is the ventilator?
The royal body said it will try to evacuate the critically ill and critically wounded from Al-Nasser and other medical centers in the south, including in Rafah. Over the past 4 months, Israel's genocidal war on Gaza has killed nearly 29,500 Palestinians, mostly women and children, and about 70,000 others have been injured. Head of the international charity group Doctors Without Borders has denounced the United States for vetoing UN Security Council resolutions on a Gaza ceasefire. Christopher Lockyer has also criticized the Security Council itself for its failure to address the crisis in Gaza. He was speaking at a Security Council meeting on Thursday. Have a listen.
We are appalled by the willingness of the United States to use its powers as a permanent council member to obstruct efforts to adopt the most evident of resolutions, one demanding an immediate and sustained ceasefire. Three times this council has had an opportunity to vote for the ceasefire that is so desperately needed, and three times the United States has used its veto power, most recently this Tuesday. We, along with the world, are closely watching how this council and its members have approached the conflict in Gaza. Meeting after meeting, resolution after resolution, this body has failed to effectively address this conflict. We have watched members of this council deliberate and delay while civilians die. A new draft resolution by the United States ostensibly calls for a ceasefire. However, this is misleading at best. This council should reject any resolution that further hampers humanitarian efforts on the ground and leads this council to tacitly endorse the continued violence and mass atrocities in Gaza. There are not enough hospital beds, there are not enough medications, and not enough supplies. Surgeons have had no choice but to carry out amputations without anesthesia on children. Our surgeons are running out of basic gauze to stop their patients from bleeding. They use it once, squeeze out the blood, wash it, sterilize it, and reuse it for the next patient. The people of Gaza need a ceasefire not when practicable, but now. They need a sustained ceasefire, not a temporary period of calm. Anything short of this is gross negligence.
Amputations without anesthetics. Meanwhile, the Israeli regime has carried out a drone strike on the occupied West Bank city of Jenin, killing two Palestinians. The violence has been escalating in the West Bank ever since the Gaza war broke out, with Israeli forces intensifying their raids in the occupied territory. Our correspondent, Mona Kandil, joined us out of Ramallah earlier for some details.
The Israelis carried out a drone strike against a vehicle. Inside this vehicle, there were at least four Palestinians. Yasser Hanoun was killed in this operation. The three others that were inside the vehicle were seriously wounded, according to paramedics. At least 11 others were wounded were in the area inside the Jenin refugee camp, including at least five children. They were playing outside their homes when the drone strike against the vehicle have taken place. Later, as you have mentioned, Palestinian Ministry of Health said that 17-year-old Palestinian Saeed Jaradat succumbed to his injuries in the Jenin hospital. So we are speaking about two Palestinians have been killed in this drone strike. 14 others were wounded, including at least three are in serious condition, and four others are Palestinian children who have been wounded in this drone strike. It's clear that even if the Israeli forces do not kill or arrest Palestinians, we can say that every day the Israeli forces are raiding Jenin city and its refugee camp, or at least the areas around the refugee camp, and cause severe destruction.
Thousands of people have taken to the streets of New York City in a Jewish-led rally to condemn the genocide in Gaza and the U.S. support for it.
I'm deeply saddened and devastated that our country is enabling this violence in the Middle East. And as an American and as a Jewish woman, I feel like it has to stop, and that we're not going to find any other solutions until we stop the bombing. And especially in light of the number of innocent people, especially children, being destroyed every day, I find it really demoralizing right now to be part of a country that's allowing this to happen.
I'm here today as not only as an American Jew, but as a combat veteran who is now an anti-war activist, among other things, to speak out against AIPAC and, in a larger scope, Zionism, and how it misrepresents Judaism. And my demand is for U.S. politicians to cut ties with AIPAC and to get more serious about what their contingents say than what AIPAC has to say, as far as demanding a ceasefire, an immediate ceasefire, a permanent ceasefire, as a beginning toward a liberated Palestine.
Protesters marched at the headquarters of the pro-Israel lobby, AIPAC. They blamed it for funding the genocide in Gaza. The demonstrators renewed calls for a ceasefire, and at least a dozen of them were arrested during the Thursday protests. It was the latest rally in New York City in solidarity with the Palestinians of Gaza. Other American cities have also witnessed similar protests on numerous occasions since the Gaza war began back in early October. And protesters poured out into the streets of the northern Yemeni city of Sa'ada, and yet another rally in support of the Palestinians in Gaza. Yemeni protesters waved Palestinian flags and chanted slogans against Israel and its main supporter, the United States. They've been holding these rallies every Friday since the Gaza war broke out in early October. Yemenis held pictures of their leaders in a show of support for their pro-Palestine operations. Those operations have targeted Israeli-linked vessels in the Red Sea in an effort to pressure the regime into stopping its campaign of genocide. Yemeni protesters have also voiced support for their army's operations against U.S. and U.K. ships in response to their ongoing airstrikes against Yemen. Airstrikes began in the wake of the Yemeni attacks in the Red Sea. And tensions are on the rise in the Red Sea over U.S.-Israeli genocide in Gaza. Israel and its Western backers are now feeling the pinch as the Yemeni army continues its attacks on Israeli and Israeli-bound ships, as well as American and British vessels. We discussed this earlier with our guests in our news review program.
Now, the leader of Yemen's Ansarullah movement says his country will intensify operations in the Red Sea.
And we will escalate also our operations in this regard as well. We have escalated in quality and in quantity. We have effectively used the rockets and the drones and even the vessels, the naval vessels as well. We have also entered submarines as well, which is something that has confused the enemy and also terrorized the enemy and also the sea. We have targeted 48 vessels in the Red Sea and the Arab Sea, and this is a very significant number.
Abdul Malik al-Houthi said the U.S. is not capable of intercepting newly developed Yemeni rockets and submarines. He said the U.S. and the U.K. have failed to limit Yemeni operations and are surprised of Sana'a's capabilities. Houthi reiterated that Sana'a will continue its military operations in the Red Sea until Israel stops its onslaught on Gaza and ends the siege on the Palestinian territory. The Yemeni leader also slammed Arab states and media for failing to support Palestinians. Houthi also slammed the Arab media for repeating US and British rhetoric against Yemen. He once again called on Yemeni people to mobilize for another rally in solidarity with Palestinians on Friday. Meanwhile, the Yemeni army spokesman Yahya Sari explains the country's recent operations in solidarity with Palestinians in Gaza and in response to the American-British aggression against the country. Let's take a listen.
The Yemeni armed forces carried out three specific military operations as follows. The first one, our missile and UAV forces fired a number of ballistic missiles and drones at various targets of the Zionist enemy in Eilat, south of occupied Palestine. Regarding the second operation in the Gulf of Aden, the Yemeni army's naval forces conducted an operation against a British ship in the Gulf of Aden, using a number of suitable naval missiles that directly hit it, causing a fire to break out on the vessel. As for the third operation, an American destroyer in the Red Sea was targeted with a number of drones.
Now, to talk more on this, we are joined by Yusuf Mowry from Sana'a and also Mr. Theo West, geopolitical analyst from Dallas, Texas. Gentlemen, welcome to the news review section. Mr. West, let's also talk about the effect it has had on the Israeli economy. There was a report out saying that Israel's economy had contracted close to 20%. How much of that do you think is because of the Yemeni operations on Israeli ports or Israeli-bound ships in the Red Sea? And also, Israeli economy, the world economy, especially the European economy as well.
With regards to the economic situation and its effect upon the Zionist apartheid state of Israel, what you have is a two-pronged approach. You have boycotts of products that are sold. American companies, certain American companies are hurting. McDonald's is hurting because of what the Zionist state is doing to the Palestinians. Starbucks is hurting because of the same reason. Now, the second part of that is that you have the shipping in the Gulf of Aden. You have that shipping in that area right there where most of that trade has been disrupted. It is being forced now, instead of going through that little strait there and then going up through the Suez Canal, it is being forced to go all the way around South Africa, shipping their products around the world. That has jacked up or raised the price of the goods around the world. So it's hurting them. So in the long run, as long as the Yemenis stand strong, they win this situation.
Mr. Mowry, what could you expect from the Yemeni army in the future?
Well, I think what you can expect from the West and from the US, Britain, is I think you're going to start to see a proposal of compromise. There's no way that the US and the West and their coalition naval task force can maintain and sustain the, you know, this embargo that's being imposed on them in the Red Sea and in the Gulf of Aden and in Bab el-Mandeb. There's just simply no way, just even based on what we've seen unfold in the past 3 months and taking into consideration that the Yemen's Ansar al-Houthi movement haven't even utilized and employed their full naval arsenal. I think the U.S. is losing, is fighting a losing battle, and I think we can expect in the coming weeks, if not months, we can expect the U.S. start to make some compromises. We can expect the U.S. to even perhaps dare, put pressure on the Israeli regime to reach a ceasefire.
Gentlemen, thank you for your time. Mr. Yusuf Mawri from Sana'a and also Mr. Theo West, geopolitical analyst from Dallas, Texas. Gentlemen, thank you for your time, sir. And with that, we come to the end of this news review section. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
Diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The Limelight. In the United States, former President Donald Trump is back on the campaign trail following a New York judge's ruling. Donald Trump was met with boos and chants while selling sneakers in Philadelphia. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The national broadcaster ABC News has covered this story and tells us more. The day after a New York judge fined him $355 million in the wake of a lengthy fraud trial, which he plans to appeal, former President Donald Trump spent his Saturday in two battleground states, Pennsylvania and Michigan. Sneakerheads, your sneakerheads, right? Does everybody in the room consider themselves a sneakerhead? Donald Trump said in a short speech to an unusual crowd that was divided between chanting for and booing at him. The event was supposed to be part of an unveiling of the latest Trump merchandise. Gold Never Surrender high-top sneakers, selling for $399, which are already listed as sold out online. And Victory 47 fragrances for $99 each. Donald Trump himself took to the stage holding a pair of the high-top sneakers. but his five-minute remarks in a heavily democratic city were sometimes barely able to be heard as members of the diverse young crowd were consistently screaming and chanting throughout. While many booed and chanted at Donald Trump, others attempted to drown them out with anti-Joe Biden and USA chants. This is a slightly different audience than I'm used to, but I love this audience, Trump said, struggling to get through his speech. He attempted to divert the attention by acknowledging his supporters in the crowd, even bringing one of them, a woman, up to the stage where she talked about how much she loves Trump because she said he's a Christian family man. They're after him for no reason. Go out and vote for Trump, she said to boos and some cheers. Trump even acknowledged he wasn't necessarily in friendly territory. Right after this, I go to Michigan. I'll be talking about a slightly different subject than sneakers. But you know what? It's all part of Americana, he said. That didn't stop him from making his pitch in Philadelphia. What's the most important thing? To go out and vote, right? We have to go out and vote. We've got to get young people out to vote, he said. Later in Michigan, an angry Donald Trump came out swinging, railing against all the prosecutors investigating him. He faces 91 criminal charges, all of which he denies. He told the fired-up crowd that if he wins the swing state, which will likely be a key battleground state, then he will win the entire election. However, he also misstated the upcoming Republican primary date and gave the wrong year for when he won Michigan. Gaffes that critics like primary rival Nikki Haley have seized on to argue that he is diminished. Donald Trump has attacked President Joe Biden for similar slips, but defended his own mental acuity. I feel my mind is stronger now than it was 25 years ago, he said back in January. The former president returned to the campaign trail this weekend in the wake of perhaps his biggest legal setback to date, when the judgment came down at the end of a years-long civil fraud lawsuit in New York. With a 92-page order issued late on Friday, 16th of February, Judge Arthur Engoron dealt Donald Trump a legal and financial blow that could permanently damage the business empire that propelled him to the presidency. In addition to the nine-figure penalty, Judge Arthur Engoron temporarily stripped Donald Trump and his sons of the ability to lead their own businesses or apply for financing. Trump's lawyers plan to appeal the ruling, vowing that higher courts will reverse Judge Engoron's ruling. USA Today has also covered this story and tells us more. Former President Donald Trump on Saturday, 17th of February, unveiled new Trump-branded sneakers during an unexpected stop in Philadelphia. Donald Trump attended an event dubbed SneakerCon, a traveling convention for collectors to buy and sell shoes, according to its website. The former president presented a shiny gold pair of sneakers at the Philadelphia Convention Center with an American flag detail on the back of the shoes. The sneakers are currently being marketed as Never Surrender High Tops and selling for $399 each. The former president's appearance split the crowd at the SneakerCon, with some attendees holding up sneakerheads love Trump signs while others booed and shouted. There's a lot of emotion in this room, Trump, who is seeking another term in office, told attendees at the event. He explained that this is something I've been talking about for 12 years or 13 years. But Trump sneakers aren't the only product he has tried to sell since leaving office. The former president has also marketed his own trading cards, and he released books featuring photographs of his time in office and letters written to him through the years. The website for the new sneakers is run by CIC Ventures LLC, a company the former president reportedly owns in a 2023 financial disclosure statement. President Joe Biden's re-election campaign immediately criticized Donald Trump over his latest product. Michael Tyler, Joe Biden's campaign communications director, said in a statement, "Donald Trump showing up to hawk bootlegged off-whites is the closest he'll get to any Air Force Ones ever again for the rest of his life." Trump revealed the sneakers just a day after a judge in New York ordered Trump and his namesake company to pay $453.5 million with additional penalties against two of his sons, and barred them from conducting business in the state of New York after fraudulently overvaluing his real estate empire. "The frauds found here leap off the page and shock the conscience," Justice Arthur Engoron wrote in a decision released on Friday, 16th of February. Qatar's Al Jazeera television network has also covered the same story. Republican presidential nominee and former President Donald Trump has made an unusual stop just a day after a judge ordered him to pay nearly $355 million in penalties for lying about his wealth and other financial offenses. Donald Trump on Saturday, 17th of February, attended an event in Philadelphia that bills itself as the greatest sneaker show on earth, where he introduced the first official Trump-branded footwear, shiny gold high shoes with an American flag on the back and a tea badge in front, priced at $399 a pair. Amid a mix of cheers and boos at the SneakerCon, an event popular among kicks and streetwear collectors, the 77-year-old businessman-turned-politician said, "There's a lot of emotion in this room." He held up and showed off a pair of gold shoes and placed one on each side of his podium. "This is something that I've been talking about for 12 years, 13 years, and I think it's going to be a big success." The Never Surrender High Tops, as described on the Get Trump Sneakers website, are being sold along with other Trump-branded shoes and Victory 7 cologne and perfume for $99 a bottle. They are for go-getters who don't know the word quit. "These kicks are for true patriot," read the sneaker's description. The website says it has no connection to Trump's campaign, though Donald Trump campaign officials promoted the appearance in online posts.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Almost 4.5 months later, the so-called civilized world continues to watch the Israeli regime's genocide of Palestinians in Gaza without stopping it. Besides bombs targeting the kids in tents, children are passing out from hunger, with some literally dying from hunger. There's still little food, little clean water, few supplies, no electricity, no fuel, and nowhere safe to go. The nightmare continues, and the majority of the world allows it, except for the axis of resistance. Well, let me get our guests in on this program. I'd like to welcome them. Out of Belfast, author and West Asia expert, Saeb Shaath. And Peter Ford, former British ambassador to Syria, out of London. Well, thank you both for being with me on this spotlight. I'd like to start off in Belfast. And Saab, at least 28,500 Palestinians have been killed in Gaza, and now 1.5 million people are in Rafah, the most populated place on earth that Israel has been bombing and threatening a ground invasion. Your perspective, what is the Israeli regime's goal at this point in time?
The Israeli regime's goal is the Zionist project's goal from the beginning, to create Eretz Israel, a greater Israel. And they want to cleanse the Palestinian people out of the Gaza Strip. They're trying to do it in a way which is will look like the pandemic got them, starvation and hunger got the people, and voluntarily they went and they broke, made a hole in the Egyptian fence at the border in Rafah, near Rafah crossing, which they call it the Philadelphia corridor. And that's the ideal scenarios which the Zionist entity genocidal war planning for from the beginning. They want to push them in a way they just want to run for their lives. And that's what they're doing. They want to create the nightmare scenario for the Egyptians and for the Palestinians as well. At the beginning, when they were saying, they asked the United Nations help to move the Palestinians out of Rafah. The United Nations officials repeatedly told them there is no safe place in Gaza, and we cannot help in like creating waves of refugees out of the Gaza Strip. That's what they were attacking the United Nations all along. They wanted now the United Nations to help them in creating another Nakba, as their officials called it at the beginning of their attacks in Gaza last October, when they called it Nakba 2023. This is the design, and this is coming on the back of, yesterday, the Wall Street Journal, they stated from sources in the United States of America, Joe Biden sent them tons of ammunition and weaponry and state-of-art weaponry, plus the money which is the Congress, of course, released for them. And we know till now Joe Biden bypassed Congress twice to arm the Zionist entity to continue its genocide. They throw a smoke screen at the international community saying they're trying to tell Netanyahu to be gentle in the way with the Palestinians people in Rafah. I can't believe what the United States of America comes out of with, and the Western leaders come out with. They are up to their neck in the genocide.
Well, let's look at that, Peter. The Israeli regime has no red line. What about its supporters in the West? Do you think there's a red line that they will not let the Zionists cross in this ethnic cleansing campaign against the Palestinian nation? Because as Saab said, I mean, again, recently the United States again gave more weapons, more money. So is there a red line, you think, for them, for the Zionist regime or not?
I believe, unfortunately, there is no red line. Experience so far suggests that the main Western powers, America, Britain, Germany, have an infinite appetite for Palestinian suffering. And there are literally no limits to Palestinian suffering which they can endure. This is embarrassing them with their public opinion. And we saw today in London and other capitals, huge demonstrations, popular demonstrations against governments and politicians. But at the end of the day, they will not do what is actually necessary. The Americans are ready.
Okay, unfortunately, we've lost Peter. Hopefully, we'll be able to reestablish that connection. Let me cross back over to Belfast and Saab.
Let's look at the reasons for the complicity of these Western countries in not only allowing the regime to do whatever it wants, but basically, well, it seems like we have lost, unfortunately, it seems right now that we have lost our connection with both Belfast and London. And hopefully we'll get to reestablish that as we continue our discussions on the situation of what is happening on the ground still, as we have now gone more than almost four and a half months of this genocide. And we're talking about at least 28,500 people being killed. But of course, estimates say that it's over 30,000, perhaps way over 30,000, as still it is believed that thousands of people are still under the rubble, and thousands perhaps of others, their bodies have been buried in mass graves or even decomposed at this point in time. This major tragedy that is taking place on the ground right now in Rafah, that basically symbolizes what has been happening not only for this 4.5 months, but in reality, we have seen this take place for 75 years against the Palestinian nation. And now it has reached a point as for a starvation that individuals, they're saying, fathers are saying that at night they actually tie stones to the stomach of their kids and their own and their family. So the hunger pains are less painful. Now, this is the reality that we are now dealing with in Gaza as the whole world continues to watch. I'm going to cross back over to Belfast, and I have Saeb back. I believe I have both of you back. Thank you so much. Sorry about that technical difficulty, viewers. But back to Saeb now. The reasons in your perspective, Saeb, for the complicity of these Western countries in allowing the regime, not just allowing them, but enhancing this genocide to take place. What do they get out of it?
I believe myself this is the deep state in the United States of America, the intelligence services and the deep state. They want the Zionist entity to continue, and the West behind them, to continue with the genocide. It's an issue to do with their hegemony in West Asia as well, which is, I always want to emphasize this point. If they lose the battle in Gaza, that's what the West believe, then the Zionist entity will be the project of creating this outpost, Zionist entity there to hegemonize the region while they are busy tackling Russia and tackling China. If we notice the package from the Congress came for three countries, Ukraine, Taiwan, and the Zionist entity. That's what shows where is the global battle of the deep state, the United States of America and its mad dogs in the West, or the Zionist entity. So if they lose this battle, if they lose the creating again the deterrence and the balance and shifting the balance of power as used to be before, then they will lose West Asia. And if they lose West Asia, it will implicate badly on their battle against China especially, because they cannot control the growth of the Chinese. They cannot control after that the balance of power with the Russians and with the Chinese. So they see it vital to take the mask off and show they are actually mean genocide in doing in Gaza. And that's why the whole countries in the region, if in even West Asia, all of it, they have to line up behind the Zionist entity, behind the Palestinian resistance. And if the Palestinian resistance lose this battle, which they are not on the ground, they are winning, but the heavy price they are making them pay, the Zionist entity and the West, is with to do with the civilians, because the resistance is job to implicate casualty and make the occupation pay heavy prices. It cannot protect the civilian infrastructure and the population, which is the duty of the Arabic countries.
Okay, stay with me on that, because we're going to get back to that point. But Peter, your take on what Saeb has said, I mean, is this basically this war of ideologies that is taking place? I mean, you are a former British official, political official. Your assessment of really what is going on and what is at stake for these Western countries to be so basically black and white with this, no matter what the Israeli regime does, it still gets 100% support from them.
Well, first of all, the government concerned, Britain, America, Germany, France, are not paying a heavy price for the support that they're giving Israel. It's an easy political choice for them because they are not paying a very visible price. Of course, there is a price. For example, the blockade on trade in the Red Sea is actually hitting the British economy, but people don't know that. They don't realize. So governments think that this is, they get a free pass. There's no penalty to support Israel to the hilt. And I just want to stress that this is about domestic politics very much. Forget the geopolitics. When I was a diplomat, we would talk about the geopolitics, but the politicians were much more interested in the domestic politics, and that's what's going on here. In the case of Britain, the government is enjoying the support of its core right-wing nationalist supporters. And at the moment, it's suffering a lot, the British government, on many fronts. But at least it needs to placate its core nationalist far-right supporters. That's what support for Israel.
Well, what about, Peter, sorry to jump in here. What about, you stated earlier that today was another large demonstration as more and more people actually show their support for the Palestinians. I mean, how does that affect the British public policy? Go ahead.
Yeah, it's a good question, but the answer is that the people who are marching are not people who are going to vote for the Conservative government anyway. They can be discounted. They'll vote for other parties. This is a foregone conclusion. So the government reckon that they're not paying a political cost. But if they did the moral thing, if they did the sensible thing for British interests, which would be to call for an immediate ceasefire, then they would pay a heavy price. They would lose many of their far-right, often racist, supporters, and they would also lose the support of half of the media, the not social media, obviously, but legacy mainstream media, much of which is solidly behind Israel. And thirdly, they would lose financial support from the supporters of Israel, the business people who are backing the most extreme racist policies.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Saab, you had mentioned about the Muslim countries in the region. Let's look at some of the complicity of Muslim and Arab nations in this genocide against the Palestinian. First of all, which countries would you say are working hand in hand with the Israeli regime or helping the Israeli regime, and why would they do that? What are they getting out of this?
There is lots of countries. I want to just mention one line coming from India, through the Emirates, through Saudi Arabia, through Jordan, and going and supplying all the logistic what's needed by the Zionist entity to cancel, in a way, the battle the brave Yemeni people showing at the Red Sea. This is part of it, but they are not succeeding. These countries, if we want to adjust historical back, little bit of historical background, these countries are created as what we call the Arab Zionists. And they are linked together with the Zionist entity. The Emiratis and the Saudis and the Jordanian are all of this creation when the British designed this entity. And these as buffer zone and the protectors of the Zionist entity. Once the Zionist regime collapses in Palestine, these regimes will go. This is what they know. So they know their existence is linked to that. They don't buy into Arabism or Islam or whatever. They buy into this regime's who are ruling there. These people who's ruling over the Emirates or Saudi Arabia were Bedouin tribes. The British picked them and made out of them, prince and royal families, and told them as long as they look after the interest of the British, which is now as well translated into the American Empire, you will be the ruling families in there. Once you get out of line, we'll replace you. And I don't want to go into stories in there, but this is obvious. So this is the benefit of these countries. And always, always work against the Palestinian liberation movement or the Arab project of unifying the Arab world as a one entity during Nasser regime in Egypt. Because if the Arabs succeeded in building one Arabic country, it will be very costly for the Americans or for any Western regime to attack any Arab world. And so will be very easy for them to cleanse the Zionist entity with this satanic project out of Palestine. So this is where the problem is. A lot of people in the region don't get it, don't understand the benefit of these royal families. A king of Jordan, he cannot even object to what the American base is doing or to what the Zionist entity require from him through Jordan. He signed the Jordanian 1994, a peace deal with the Zionist entity for what? They handed over in 1967 the West Bank and Jerusalem. They didn't have any kind of the clashes. It's all cover up for beefing up the Zionist entity and protecting it. So they are part of the project, part of what the American design in the region. They cannot go out of line.
Well, I'd like to look at the other side of things now, Peter, because we do have Muslim countries or groups that, on the other hand, are very much supportive of the Palestinian people, whether we look at what is happening from the Yemeni people, or we look at Hezbollah, or we look at some of the Iraqis or others. I want to talk about that side of things and the importance of what is happening on that side of the coin.
Well, what the Yemenis are doing is incredibly important. Tonight, Netanyahu made an important speech. He faced today massive demonstrations in Tel Aviv. Many Israelis want him to give priority to getting the hostages released rather than his mad plans to crush Hamas. And he acknowledged that there were deep economic problems facing Israel. Now, this is the first time that he has acknowledged these problems, but they are real and they are caused by the war generally, but most specifically by the blockade operated by Ansar Allah, the Yemeni group. And this has resulted just a few days ago in the Moody's credit agency giving Israel a downgrade, which means that the government will have to pay more money on international money markets to borrow. This is really serious for Israel. Tens of thousands of Israelis are not able to go to their homes in the north and the south. Hundreds of thousands of reservists are taken away from their work every week. So this is a factor which is often overlooked. Similarly, the fact that one-third of the Israeli army is tied up in the north because of the pressure from Hezbollah. So the Hezbollah and Ansar Allah are basically doing what the Americans won't do, which is put real pressure on Israel to bring this crisis to an end quickly.
And we hope so. And with that, it brings us to the end of the program. I'd like to thank both of you for being with us. Saib Shath, author and West Asia expert out of Belfast. Peter Ford, former British ambassador to Syria out of London. And thank you for being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi, signing out for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran. Goodbye.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
And God said, "Let there be light," and there was light.
The Creator made Adam in his image, then placed the world in his care. May you walk alongside the Creator in righteousness.
God of Abraham, take my child into thy hands, that he may live to thy service.
God has spoken to us before, through Abraham, Noah, Moses, and through Jesus Christ. Why should we be so surprised that God speaks to us now through Muhammad?
Viewpoint,
a critique of movies with religious themes on IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program, Viewpoint, the movie critique program on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Brother Yasser and Sayyid Abdullah, my guest speakers in the studio. Brother Yasser, assalamu alaikum and welcome to the program.
Alaikum salam wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh. Always nice being with you, Brother Muhammad Jawad.
Thank you very much. Sayyid Abdullah, greetings to you, assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa greetings as well.
Thank you very much. We are continuing, actually, the criticism of the movie Seventh Son, directed by Sergei Butrov, produced in 2014. Of course, we haven't finished its criticism in the previous episodes, and inshallah, we'll do that in this very episode today. Before me asking you questions about this movie, let's take a listen to a short part of this movie and then we'll be back. Don't go away.
With the blood moon's rise and Malcolm's arrival, the creatures of the dark will be more frequent and more powerful. These are her lieutenants. This is Radu. He has an army of assassins. gods get spells.
That is disgusting. What does that kill?
Cowardice. Sarakan takes the form of a leopard. Zarahadra is the king of swords. Your consistency is admirable, Mr. War. Of all of them, Malkin is the strongest. She is the queen.
You know, I've seen Mother Malkin in my visions. It's going to take a lot more than salt and iron to defeat her.
Back to the program Viewpoint, the movie critique program on RIB English Radio. With me, Mama Jad, hosting this program, and Sayyid Abdullah and Brother Yasser, my guest speakers, helping me criticize the movie Seventh Son, directed by Sergei Butrov, produced in 2014. Sayyid Abdullah, in this part of the movie, the master is teaching his apprentice about some of the creatures of the dark, as he calls them, that change shapes into bears, leopards, and the like.
Yep.
Is he really referring to the shape-shifting abilities or ability of the jinn or the jinns?
Maybe. I mean, the only creatures that we know of that they have the capacity to shape-shift are actually jinn and the shayateen. So, because, I mean, all the shayateen are jinn initially, but they are the only creatures that we are aware of that they have the capacity to shape-shift.
And also angels can shape-shift, right?
Angels, obviously, they can take form. See, it's not shape-shifting. It's basically taking form rather than just shape-shifting. So the malaika, they
cannot change the shape into a dog, as I've heard in traditions, right?
I mean,
or something like the pigs.
An angel can't take shape of a dog or a pig because maybe they are the essence of Najasa.
Yes.
That could be accurate. But I don't see why would angels need to take shape into anything. The only angel that we're, from text-wise, speaking about text, that took shape and takes shape is Jibra'il,
yes,
the archangel. So he takes the shape
to,
of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa sallam. He used to take the shape of what a guy called by Duhya al-Kalbi. Duhya al-Kalbi was known to be a very beautiful man in his time. And so Jibra'il used to take his shape and come with a prophet, at times, obviously. And the Prophet made a comment. He said, every time you see me with Duhya, don't approach me. So people understood that Duhya is, when he's talking to him, it must be Jibra'il in the form of Duhya al-Kalbi.
Mm-hmm.
So so unless they have a reason to take shape, take form, they will take form. Otherwise, malaika don't need to take form. The satans, however, the shayateen or jinn, in other words, they have to maybe deceive a person or play on a person or something. So they might take more shapes. The mm-hmm. classical story is that shaitan took a shape in a form of an old man when he asked Quraysh to go kill the Prophet, historically speaking, in text-wise.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so shaitan was known to take a lot of forms, you know mm-hmm. what I mean? He was known to take a form of animals and so on and so forth. So as far as I know, the answer is that jinn, they do take shape and form. Now, were these guys in the movie referring to that ability of jinn? Maybe. Or it could be like stemmed from it. Or sometimes it's just a Hollywood fantasy that they have that shape-shifting thing. Because mm-hmm. shape-shifting is pretty much in a lot of movies, like yes. especially in Marvel movies, DC yes. movies, the X-Men series. They would have characters that change form. Even Transformers, for the love of God.
Yes.
Cars can transform into, I don't know, different creatures.
Yes.
So, yeah, the notion is always there. But did they take it from the fact that jinn themselves shift-shape? Maybe, maybe not.
What about mankind? Can they?
We can't shift shape.
Thank you very much. Let's take a short break by listening to a part of the movie Seventh Son, directed by Sergei Butrov, produced in 2014, and we'll come back with his criticism. Stay with us.
I don't understand. How can you be here?
I'm not Tom. I've passed on from this world. I stood against Mother Malkin. And I failed. But you will not fail. You are a seventh son, Tom. But you are also the son of a witch. There's never been anyone like you. Only you can wield the Umbran Stone and end her reign of darkness before it begins.
Back to the program Viewpoint, the movie